KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Food banks are trying to adjust after the U.S. Department of Agriculture cut $500 million from a nationwide emergency food assistance program. One of those impacted organizations meets the pressing need for food access within the Crow and Northern Cheyenne tribes of southeastern Montana. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kayla DeRoche reports from Crow Agency on a recent day in April.
Andrea, get the table.
It's late Tuesday morning in a gas station parking lot off Interstate 90, and Centerpol founder Peggy Wilknown Buffalo directs the setup of a table, soon to be stacked with boxes of canned salmon, loose potatoes, and meat. Cars are already lining up to pick up food.
We try to be in a location where it's easier for them to come from the housing projects and from around town.
With only a few small grocery stores and gas stations located across this large swath of southeast Montana, the Crow and Northern Cheyenne reservations are considered food deserts. The grassroots nonprofit, Centerpol, tries to fill that gap with help from the Montana Food Bank Network, and Well-Known Buffalo says the need is high.
Sometimes we stay until 3, but today a lot of people have been calling.
Well-Known Buffalo talks about her concerns going forward. Montana Food Bank Network recently learned about cuts slated for more than 70 food banks across the state, Centerpol included. Montana Food Bank Network distributes food through the Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP, a U.S. Department of Agriculture program that directs food to low-income areas. Montana Food Bank Network program manager Jesse Schroffnagel says they had committed to delivering food through the end of the year when they learned that one of TFAP's primary funding streams had been eliminated.
And as of the beginning of this month, all of those truckloads have been canceled. So what that amounts to is roughly 40% of our total TFAP allocation that we're anticipating not receiving for the remainder of the year.
According to records through the Montana Food Bank Network, the cuts account for more than a quarter of the total food Centerpol estimates it distributes in a year. Well-Known Buffalo says Centerpol plans to navigate the cuts to their pantry by establishing public gardens to grow food and indigenous plants they source from the hills in the region.
We're going to get hit with the craziness of what our government is doing. But the ones that are going to suffer is my people, us, Native.
Reporting from Crow Agency, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Native American California Assemblymember James Ramos, chair of the Native American Caucus, is insisting on a hearing to address the state auditor's newest findings dealing with the University of California system in returning Native American remains and cultural items to tribes. A third report from the state auditor was issued this week. Ramos says the audit shows UC lacks accountability and urgency in returning remains and cultural items required by the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, and its state counterpart, CalNAGPRA. According to the report, UC continues to hold the human remains of thousands of individuals and hundreds of thousands of potential cultural items. Ramos says it's very disturbing to him as a Serrano Cahuilla person who still conducts reburials of his people that a law implemented 35 years ago is still being discussed today. The report finds the university has not ensured the proper care and security of potential cultural items and says at the current pace, it will likely take more than a decade to repatriate all of the collections. Ramos says the ancestors of tribal Californians deserve to be interred respectfully and in the traditions of their people. And he says lawmakers need to assess and or create penalties for noncompliance with the laws. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The revenue situation has deteriorated a lot since we submitted the bills and worked off a budget in December. The second reason for the veto is there's no policy in the bill.
Governor Dunleavy again vetoes a statewide education funding boost. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 17th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, new travel restrictions for federal workers cancel a landslide conference in Southeast where slides have killed a dozen people in the last decade.
Landslides don't care who runs the government. Like, we're still going to have to deal with landslides here.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Local sponsors do right by their business and for the community by supporting public media stations. Thank you for considering adding your corporate support. You'll be in good company.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed a closely watched education funding bill this morning. The bill would have boosted basic per-student funding, known as the base student allocation, by $1,000. He announced the veto at a news conference in Juneau.
There are really two reasons for the veto. One of the reasons is that the revenue situation has deteriorated a lot since we submitted the bills and worked off of budget in December. And the second reason for the veto is there's no policy in the bill.
The veto was widely expected. Dunleavy has called for any school funding increases to be tied to policy changes that he says would boost student performance. Lawmakers had been working with the governor's staff since early this year on a compromise that included a funding boost and policy changes, but negotiations appeared to break down in recent weeks. The bill that reached Dunleavy's desk contained nothing aside from the funding boost. The bill passed with a one-vote majority in each chamber, and it requires a two-thirds majority to override the governor's veto. But House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent who leads the Democrat-heavy House Majority Caucus, says he hopes the vote highlights the importance of increased school funding.
Our public school system in Alaska is in crisis, and that's something that we need to focus on.
At the news conference for the veto, Dunleavy announced a new competing bill that would boost basic school funding by roughly half as much. It contains less general-purpose school funding than lawmakers and the governor approved last year on a one-time basis. It would also target significant funding at homeschool and literacy initiatives, and Dunleavy says it would make it easier to create new charter schools and allow students to apply to attend schools outside their home district. Some lawmakers, especially in the largely Democratic Senate majority, say they're not convinced the policies will improve student test scores. And they say negotiating with the governor's staff has been a frustrating experience marked by shifting demands. But other legislators, like House Education Committee co-chair Rebecca Himshut, say they're optimistic they can reach a compromise.
I think there's a lot we can work on. He talks about having done a lot of negotiation. I want people to know that negotiation was never with me directly. I've had no meetings with the governor.
Himshut called on the governor to come to the table and negotiate himself. Four fatal landslides in southeast Alaska over the last decade have sparked a region-wide effort to better understand and prepare for mounting risk. That effort was supposed to include a major conference last month. But as Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, the gathering was canceled after it became clear that some federal agencies would not be able to attend.
an estimated 80 fire chiefs, city planners, emergency managers, and other officials from across Southeast were set to gather in Sitka back in March for a second annual landslide conference. Their goal? To pull landslide-related knowledge, resources, and strategies over the course of 2 days. Ron Heinz is a senior researcher with the Sitka Sound Science Center, which helped organize the event.
This is the primary venue for dealing with the landslide issue in Southeast Alaska, is this organization, because we bring together, you know, the people that are living in the affected communities in Southeast Alaska.
But that didn't happen. Heinz says the group was informed that representatives from federal agencies working on the issue, such as the National Weather Service and U.S. Geological Survey, would not be able to participate due to new restrictions on travel by federal employees. Heinz says there was an agreement that it didn't make sense to go ahead with the conference without them. Also contributing to the decision, Heinz says, was general uncertainty around how federal agencies would interact with regional landslide efforts moving forward.
It would be very difficult to kind of, you know, make plans and do things in the future without any sort of certainty of what the government landscape was going to look like in the next 12 months or so.
Initially, the hope was to reschedule the conference several months out, but Heinz says lingering uncertainty about federal policy probably means it won't happen this year. Derek Poinsett has participated in the regional partnership as a member of the Haines Planning Commission. He says these types of events are crucial to ensure landslide-related research and planning efforts aren't siloed in different communities.
This group is a good way for all of those people and resources to kind of come together and help each other out and share information.
Poinsett adds that Haines has benefited from the effort, including by way of a state-funded landslide risk analysis. He says the borough had that opportunity due to connections made via a region-wide coalition that spearheaded the conference. It's called the Southeast Alaska Landslide Information and Preparedness Partnership. Lisa Bush runs the group. She says the conference is important, but she's also worried about what the federal travel limitations and funding cuts might mean for the region's handling of landslides more broadly.
Landslides don't care who runs the government. Like, we're still going to have to deal with landslides here. It's a very big geohazard. We have more landslides than any other place in the country.
Bush says federal agencies have played a key role in helping gauge landslide risk in Southeast, including by installing monitoring equipment. That work will likely be affected, she says, if federal employees can't get back to the region. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfeld.
Nearly 2 months have passed since the University of Alaska Board of Regents directed leadership to scrub mentions of diversity, equity, and inclusion from websites and publications. The action was in response to federal threats to withhold funding from universities. As KTOO's Jamie Deep reports, the University of Alaska Southeast has retained its services and funding for now.
There have been some big changes across the University of Alaska system due to the Trump administration's crackdown on DEI. Universities in Fairbanks and Anchorage have experienced federal funding cuts, revoked student visas, and office reorganizations for people serving Alaska Native students and other underrepresented communities. But these things aren't happening at the University of Alaska Southeast. UAS Chancellor Aparna Palmer said at a recent virtual town hall, the campus's own Native and Rural Students Center hasn't changed.
The Indigenous heritage of Alaska is so central to our identity as an institution. At UAS, it is part of the fabric of who we are. And so our commitment to that continues.
Instead, UAS continues to review and scrub mentions of DEI on university webpages, a directive the Board of Regents passed in February. One name change includes the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Cultural Safety. It's now the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on Belonging, Empowerment, Access, Representation, and Safety. A UAS spokesperson said in an email that staff have updated about half of the webpages as of Wednesday morning. She said they expect to update the rest by the end of the semester. Once that's done, she said they'll start reviewing PDFs, catalogs, and other documents. UA's president said in a press release more than $5 million in federal grants has been frozen or canceled. At UAS, a federal grant was temporarily frozen, but the UAS spokesperson said that's since been restored. While the changes have been smaller at UAS compared to other campuses, students like sophomore Poppy McBride say the decision to scrub mentions of DEI has been demoralizing.
a lot of people are upset by it because this is just ignoring great majorities of like the students that attend our schools.
McBride says they appreciate the support from university staff since the decision passed through.
I'm grateful for the leadership we do have at this school, trying their very best to support students throughout it all. I think a great majority of our faculty is pushing to stay inclusive and to keep supporting students and to not ignore all the identities and people who will be pushed kind of under the rug by this move.
In the meantime, McBride and other students are finding community through campus events and student clubs as the Trump administration continues to investigate and threaten other universities across the country. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jamie Deep.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kenai Peninsula crafters wonder where they'll shop after their supply store closes.
You never truly miss them until they're really gone, but we all shop at Joann's at some time or another, so I think it's going to have a big impact.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Police say a kicked-out car window led to a man's fatal shooting last night in South Anchorage. 24-year-old Michael Nelson is charged with first and second degree murder. Police have not publicly identified the victim. According to a charging document, Nelson and two other men were in a parked vehicle when the victim walked up to it and got into a dispute with them. When the victim kicked out a window of the car, Nelson allegedly got out and wrestled with him, telling one of the other men to get a gun from a nearby home. Once Nelson had the gun, police say he chased the victim until the man stopped and turned around. That's when Nelson allegedly shot him several times. Medics who responded at about 5 p.m. Wednesday took the man to a local hospital where he later died. Police say Nelson told them his dog lived in the car and was hurt when the man kicked in the window. According to the charges, he said, quote, "I was not going to let that slide." Nelson is being held at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. An eruption at Mount Spur, the closest volcano to Alaska's population centers, is now less likely, researchers said today. Last month, the Alaska Volcano Observatory warned Alaskans that observations indicated an eruption at Spur was more likely than not. The volcano sits about 80 miles west of Anchorage and has only erupted twice in recorded history, once in 1953 and again in 1992. More recently, though, researchers are seeing fewer indications that Spur will erupt. Matt Haney, the Volcano Observatory's head scientist, says an eruption is still possible.
Overall, the likelihood of eruption has decreased from a month ago. However, the earthquake activity, especially deep beneath the volcano, has not decreased. So the volcano is still at an unrest level that's higher than background.
Haney says there have been fewer shallow earthquakes at Spur, though, and the rate at which the volcano is inflating has slowed. Volcanic gas emissions are another indicator of a possible eruption, but they have been difficult to measure recently. Haney says poor weather had prevented the researchers from flying over the volcano to take measurements.
We've been unable to keep up our pace of volcanic gas emission measurement flights.
Haney says people should continue their preparations for a possible eruption, which he says could still happen within weeks or months. Also today, the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management requested that the public work to battle disinformation about Spur by consulting with official sources like the state and the Volcano Observatory. Officials added that tourism, travel, and recreation are currently unaffected by Spur. The observatory also recently posted a live stream where viewers can monitor Spur themselves. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation spent time addressing tariffs and federal layoffs during remarks at Kodiak's annual commercial fishing trade show, ComFish. The three-day event kicked off on Tuesday. But as KMXT's Brian Venois reports, the group had no clear answers on the Trump administration's shifting priorities.
It was standing room only during Senator Lisa Murkowski's address at Comfish on Tuesday. Murkowski broke some of the tension with a joke about giving a talk to Kodiak high schoolers, who she met with ahead of her remarks to the conference.
My team that was with me said afterwards, toughest interview ever. So questions from you guys going to be easy peasy after your high school students.
Then she took a turn to talk about the elephant in the room since the Trump administration took over. Tariffs.
We don't have the certainty that we would like with regards to the tariffs coming out of Washington, D.C. right now. I think the certainty that we know is that even without having the tariffs put in place, we're already seeing and feeling the impacts on Alaska's economy and really the economy as a whole.
Murkowski says she's aware that tariffs could increase the cost of consumer goods and how that can be exacerbated in rural places like Kodiak.
When we're talking about the issues that you are all engaged with when it comes to Alaska's seafood and your ability to access and to compete fairly on the global markets, the reality is that tariffs just make everyday life more expensive.
Murkowski says she's also concerned about the layoffs at NOAA, particularly as preparations are underway for the summer trawl survey for various species. She says she's reminding anyone who will listen why the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's fisheries departments are important. Senator Dan Sullivan has faced criticism recently for not speaking with constituents amidst the federal changes. He called into Comfish via Zoom this year and focused on some of the Trump administration's policies he believes are helping Alaska.
What I keep doing is brandishing this executive order from the president on Alaska. This thing is all about unleashing Alaska's economy, resources, including fish and our fisheries.
He says he reminds other officials of that when working with Elon Musk's controversial Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. President Trump and DOGE have already slashed NOAA's staff. The administration is proposing massive cuts to the organization's budget by about $1.5 billion next year. Sullivan, however, didn't address the proposed cuts directly.
And I've been working with the DOGE guys, the leadership, and when they've made mistakes, particularly as it relates to anything in this executive order, that'll hurt Alaska's economy, including our fisheries. I have very strongly advocated for, hey, guys, you got to reverse some of this stuff. Can't do stuff that hurts our economy.
He says he's also trying to work with the administration officials on how to provide some consistency for the seafood industry despite the president's on-again, off-again tariffs. Sullivan says he wants to get fisheries included on a relief program available to farmers negatively affected by trade wars, although any efforts to get seafood-related support into the farm bill have so far stalled in Congress. Alaska's newest member of the congressional delegation, Representative Nick Begich III, faced criticism during a telephonic town hall early in the Trump administration, and this time spent his time in person at Comfish. He told the crowd he's generally in favor of Trump's changes and that one of his top concerns for fisheries is to improve domestic markets.
When it comes to seafood exports, Alaska should have the advantage, not just the level playing field.
He says he wants to see better representation of Alaska seafood in programs like school lunches and distinguishing Alaska origin products in stores. Begich echoed some of the same rhetoric on tariffs as Senator Sullivan. He says it's unfair for Russia and China to undercut Alaska and sell in U.S. markets.
We're looking at ways to harmonize those international standards and ensure that there is full reciprocity when folks want to enter our markets. We should be able to enter their markets on the same terms. That is the backdrop for this tariff discussion.
Begich says he's concerned about the national debt and applauded DOGE's efforts to curb excess spending. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Would you like to play a part in the public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
Housing was the top concern for most Alaskans calling 211 last year, according to the center's annual report. The statewide call center, run by United Way, directs Alaskans to social services and assistance programs. According to the report, in the North Slope region and Southwest region, callers were concerned most with accessing food, and in the interior, the top concern was income. Sue Brogan is Chief Operating Officer of United Way of Anchorage. She says housing has remained important to callers across the state, and she says call center data helps inform legislators about their constituents.
They really like the regional information. So we took a look at the seven regions this year. Four of the regions had housing still as the number one top category.
And she says for all four of those regions, housing inquiries made up at least a quarter of all calls. Brogan says the top-level concerns of Alaskans have not changed all that much over the years, but she says in the past few years, calls are notably longer and the tenor has changed.
We have individuals that call us back quite frequently that just want to talk about things or want us to hear about how the referral went, which we really want to know.
Call center employees say callers are also sometimes wanting to vent about their lives. Brogan says they're also fielding calls that require language translation more often. Brogan says 211 is free and confidential, and she hopes all Alaskans feel comfortable calling when they need help. A Service High School senior won a National Honor Society Award last week at a ceremony in Washington, D.C. Natalie Hodge-Hanula was one of five students across the country chosen from over 16,000 applicants and will receive a $10,000 scholarship. Hodge-Hanula endured a difficult upbringing before finding success in school and serving her community. Adults in her life suffered from alcoholism and addiction, and she says she didn't learn to read until she was about 10 years old. She credits her teachers at Ocean View Elementary with helping her develop a love of learning.
Just having one teacher, one person really believe in you really set me up for success there.
Hodge-Hanula says she was supported by her grandmother and older sister as a child. She fondly remembers watching her sister graduate from Service High and making a promise to herself at that moment.
I remember seeing the valedictorian and I'm like, that's going to be me someday. And, you know, I was like, I'm going to work as hard as I can to get that spot and get that dream.
Next month, Hodge-Hanula will graduate as the Service High valedictorian for the class of 2025. She's not only a straight-A student, but spends much of her free time volunteering. Hodge-Hanula says she applied to various scholarships to pay for college and has been awarded full rides to each of the schools she applied to. She says she was surprised to hear her name called as the National Honor Society Character Award winner last week.
Really, just stepping up on the stage, I did cry a little bit, but it was more so just like realizing that I was enough, and you know, it was kind of just a great way to represent Service as well, so I was really honored to be able to bring that home for everyone.
Hodge-Hanula will defer her award winnings from the National Honor Society until grad school, where she plans to study neuroscience. She hopes to one day become a pediatric surgeon. Well, Joann Fabric and Crafts announced in February that it will close all stores nationwide, including five in Alaska. As a result, crafters on the Kenai Peninsula are wondering where they'll buy art supplies once the busy Soldotna store closes. As KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports, some local craft shops are hoping to bridge the gap.
It's a Thursday morning in the multi-purpose room of Soldotna's Christ Lutheran Church, where a handful of quilters gather weekly to work on projects. Deborah Standifer fires up her sewing machine and stitches a blue circular quilt.
Okay.
What are you working on?
This is a Mariner star for a good friend, so it's a gift.
But despite Standifer's enthusiasm, there's a palpable feeling of loss among the group. Just two traffic lights north on the Kenai Spur Highway, Joann's Fabric Store is hosting a going-out-of-business sale. The Soldotna location is set to close later this month. Standifer says she mostly shops at Joann's for its selection of quilt batting, or insulated material between the quilt top and backing fabric.
you never truly miss them until they're really gone, but that it's we all shop at Joann's at some time or another, so I think it's going to have a big impact.
The Ohio-based retailer filed for bankruptcy last year amid financial troubles. It originally planned to close about two-thirds of its stores, like those in Anchorage and Juneau. But the company wasn't able to find a buyer willing to keep any stores open. For quilters on the Kenai Peninsula, there aren't many other local options to turn to. One of them is North Beach Quilting in Kenai, which sells higher-end fabrics. It's a lot smaller than Joann's, but shop owner Shonda Powell says many established quilters in the area already shop there.
I get my fabrics from, like, they're made in Bali or Indonesia, so the stuff that I have is not something that you're going to find at Joann Fabrics.
Since the Soldotna Joann store announced its closure, Powell says she sees new customers every day. Some are looking for items her store doesn't carry. Powell is hoping to expand the small shop's inventory as much as possible. But Powell says she's sad that crafters will soon have fewer options on the Kenai Peninsula to choose from. She's concerned that Joann's closure will impact quilters on a budget and those new to the craft.
I think that if somebody's learning how to sew, this is not the place that they pick first.
Crafters say they shop at Joann's because of the store's breadth of inventory. Barbara Steckel is a longtime member of Soldotna's Thursday quilting group. She says she's used to being able to find a wide range of items at Joann's, like every shape and size of Velcro.
Well, it's definitely going to have an impact because when I'm working on something, I'm used to running in there and being able to find most of the supplies.
Steckel is also involved with Stitches of Love, a local group that makes and donates quilts to those in need. Even though much of the group's quilting material is donated, they buy a lot. And Steckel fears the store's closing could make it hard to stay within their budget.
We've been looking at other sources and looking at the prices, and yes, we're not quite sure what the impact is going to be.
For quilters on the Kenai Peninsula, Joann's closure will affect more than just their quilting projects. Many also knit, paint, or scrapbook, and are not sure where to go for their crafting supplies. Some say they'll resort to Walmart or online retailers. Standifer, with the Thursday Soldotna Quilting Group, says Joann's is a landmark for Kenai Peninsula crafters. She says the store's closure is a blow to the community.
You go into to Joann Fabric and everybody in town's there, you know, so it's kind of a melting pot for, you always see somebody that you know, and it's just been there for a long time, so it's kind of a highlight to the community.
Standifer says crafters from across the Kenai Peninsula would visit the Soldotna store and often make purchases at other local businesses. She's concerned about how Joann's closure will affect the store's employees and those who craft to make money. Reporting on the Kenai Peninsula, I'm Hunter Morrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Jamie Deep in Juneau, Avery Elfelt in Haines, Chris Clint, Wesley Early, and Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Brian Venwan in Kodiak, and Hunter Morrison on the Kenai Peninsula. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
sunglasses as I step into the sun. There's no recollection of the evil things I've done. It feels like I must have had some fun.
What happened? I start to cry.
And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't.